High school sports have traditionally given kids a chance to have fun, stay active, and compete during the academic year. These days, though, they may be taking on a more professional feel. Things like traveling summer leagues and personal trainers are getting more common for top athletes and teams, as that raises the costs and time commitment needed to keep up. More lower-income students are taking a pass on sports altogether. Derek Thompson is a staff writer for The Atlantic. His recent piece is called "Meritocracy is Killing High School Sports." Derek, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Well, before we get into the income breakdown on this, what are we seeing overall when it comes to the number of kids sticking with athletics into high school?
So in the 2018-2019 school year, the number of kids that were participating in high school sports declined for the first number in three decades. That was at least the headline that I saw on ESPN as I was beginning to research some of the elements of this article. But it turns out that 30 years ago, the high school population itself was shrinking, and that's because of a sort of short-term fall-off in births after the baby boom. So this past year, I have calculated, is the only period on record where high school sports participation declined even as school attendance increased. We've just never seen anything like this before. And so in this piece, I basically dug into exactly why this is happening.
And you say this isn't a universal. There is a family income difference here. What do we see?
Yeah, absolutely. So what you basically see is that starting at the youth sports level, kids from higher income families are now much, much more likely to be playing team sports than children from low income families. Here is the statistic. Kids from homes earning more than $100,000 are now twice as likely to play a team sport at least once a day as kids from families earning less than $25,000. And what that tells me is that a lot of these richer parents not only are more active in their children's lives or spending more on child enrichment, but also what they're doing is they're putting their children in these pay-to-play youth sports leagues, these travel teams, where they'll essentially spend hundreds, thousands of dollars and lots of time moving these kids from county to county, putting them on teams where they're playing other typically middle-class or high-income kids from, you know, a county or a state away. And as a result, they're essentially pulling these kids out of the local rec leagues. As a result, these local rec leagues that are supposed to be somewhat communitarian, they're withering on the vine. They're becoming desiccated. And low-income kids are pulling back from them, deciding to stay home because the middle and higher-income kids aren't playing with those teams anyway. And as a result, this system by which the higher classes are trying to, you know, cherish their children, love their children, give their children a leg up and make them more successful at these youth sports, they're essentially desiccating the local rec league.
What does that mean then for lower income kids who may not have that athletic opportunity, who don't end up playing, say, in high school?
Well, there are at least two categories I think we should be worried about. The first category to be worried about is all of this data, all this research that seems to indicate that exercise and playing sports, especially when you're a kid, is really, really important for cognitive development. So if low-income kids are cut out from that, that's something to be very thoughtful about, especially since this is a really sensitive period in the creation and in these children's cognitive development years. The second thing is college, and that's that, you know, athletic recruiting now is arguably the biggest form of affirmative action in American higher education. Division I and Division II schools spend $3 billion on student-athlete scholarships. So if low-income kids are less likely to be prepared to get a slice of that $3 billion, then not only do you have sort of the cognitive impairment of being cut off from youth sports when they were young, you also have the fact that they are cut off from this opportunity to get sports scholarships from D1 and D2 colleges when they're older teenagers.
I think a lot of times the public reputation of those athletic scholarships, if people look at it positively, is, hey, this is great. This gives kids from poorer families a different way to get into college. How does it actually play out?
Right. That is exactly what I thought was the situation. I thought that the vast majority of these student-athlete scholarships were going toward kids who, you know, were coming from a low-income background, who say, you know, neither their parents went to school. That's not the case at all. In 2010, just 28% of D1 basketball players were from first-generation college students, meaning they came probably from low-income families. You know, that percentage is actually falling rather quickly. So today, fewer than 1 in 7 students receiving athletic scholarships across all D1 sports are coming from families where neither parent went to college. That is not a picture where most of this money is going to kids from low-income families. It's a picture where a lot of this student-athlete money is going to middle-income and even high-income students. One researcher, Tom Ferry, that I spoke to from the Aspen Institute, called this the slow-motion gentrification of college sports, that essentially you had this pie of money that we might have, you know, decades ago hoped would mostly go to low-income kids who needed the money to go to college, and now it's mostly going to the upper middle class.
Derek Thompson is with us, staff writer at The Atlantic. His recent piece is called Meritocracy is Killing High School Sports. He looks at the numbers of kids playing high school sports going down, especially for low-income kids. I don't know if you wrote the headline, Derek, but meritocracy. Talk about that as a concept as it plays into all of this.
Sure. I didn't write the headline. At The Atlantic, we have editors who work in the headlines, but I'm happy to defend the headline here live. So I think that, you know, there is a definition of meritocracy, elusive and maybe even delusional definition of meritocracy that basically says that outcomes equal deservedness, that people who get student scholarships or people who succeed in the labor force are inherently deserving. But the way that meritocracy seems to work, I would argue, is that higher income parents essentially can afford better opportunities for their children, can afford better teachers and better coaches, can afford more shots on net throughout life. And as a result, high-income students tend to succeed in a way that lower-income students don't. I think you see exactly that dynamic playing out in the youth sports and high school sports level, that essentially you have high-income parents who, through often sheer love of their children, are paying for their children to play with richer, more talented kids on special, pay-to-play travel leagues, which is setting them up for a more successful high school experience, which itself is setting them up to become student athletes at the D1 and D2 levels. So that which appears to be a kind of a pure meritocracy is basically a phenomenon of class domination.
Now, you say, as you say, this is parents trying to be good parents here. Is there a bad guy in the story, or did we just sort of evolve this weird system by accident?
Yeah, that's a good question. I tend in my writing to not identify, or at least to not try to identify, you know, bad guy individuals. I do think that overall what's happening at the youth sports level is bad. And I do think that a lot of high-income parents who think that they are acting through sheer love of their individual child are in fact doing bad. They are hurting their communities. They're hurting the lower and middle class members of their communities. And making it harder for, you know, those children to have an equal opportunity. So I think that they are that the consequence of their behavior is negative. But I also want to make clear that I understand that the actions that they're taking are being taken out of love for their kids.
You've talked to some different experts on this. Are people offering different models, different ways that this could work better and get those low income kids into these sports that keep them active and maybe give them that opportunity?
Yeah, there are a couple examples. Unsurprisingly, they tend to come out of Scandinavia. I believe, if I recall, Norway has actually been rather innovative in terms of making it impossible for travel league pay-to-play teams to even evolve. They've also done something where they've reduced the number of championships that exist at the youth sports level, which makes it sort of foolhardy in the first place to try to scramble to get your kid on the most successful team. You know, we might consider that to be kind of participation trophy culture, but it seems to actually have a really positive outcomes for the sort of overall coaching of middle and lower income kids. I mean, Norway absolutely dominated at the Winter Olympics recently. I think they had one of the most successful Olympics in world history very recently. So clearly what Norway is doing seems to be working at the international level, and they have a much more sort of participatory approach to youth sports.
Derek Thompson is with us, staff writer at The Atlantic. We're talking to him about an income divide and who's playing high school sports. We'll go to your calls now. David is with us in Gurnee, Illinois. David, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call. So I have two quick comments and then a question. I'm in the 100,000 plus, and I have two girls, and they don't play sports. I guess I was wondering if you had ever really looked at male versus female. And then my real, I guess, comment is I watch college basketball, college football, like most people do. I don't see the athletes that are getting these scholarships at Division I schools that fit, I guess, what your guest is saying in terms of upper middle class getting these scholarships, because I don't see that.
David, thanks for the call. You looked at the numbers, Derek, for overall scholarships, and it does seem to be weighted one way or another, right?
Are we talking about gender? Are we talking about income here?
For the income first, yeah, then we'll get into the gender part.
Sure. I'll take the questions or comments sort of as they came. First of all, I couldn't see a major difference between male and female participation in high school sports. What seems to be the case, though, is that a lot of different sports are in decline. Football is – tackle football is in the steepest decline in terms of participation among high school sports. There's not a – that's not a – crazy mystery. A lot of that has to do with fears about head trauma, but also basketball, baseball, golf, all those are losing players too. One stat that actually is relevant for girls is that the number of girls playing high school basketball has actually fallen to its lowest level since the early 1990s, I found, and that's not a story that head injuries alone can explain. On the issue of D1 and D2 athletes and their income, look, you can't see income. Income isn't a thing you can literally see. What you can see are the statistics, and the statistics are that in 2010, just 28% of D1 basketball players were first-generation college students. A first-generation college student is a pretty good proxy for a low-income family because education and income tends to be pretty highly correlated in the United States. So the fact that number is low and getting lower tells me that the teams that D1 schools are putting forth on the basketball court are increasingly populated by children from middle class families.
David, thanks for the call. We'll go to Barb now in Lake Hocum. Barb, hi.
Hi. I'm a school counselor, and I'm very familiar with sports and the benefit of it. Sports have become our at-risk program because we're no longer funded for at-risk. But it provides an opportunity to keep kids in school. It gives them motivation and also gives them mentorship through the coaching staff. So we're losing a really valuable component when our students in lower income groups aren't able to participate.
Interesting, Barb. Thanks for the call. Derek, what do you think?
Yeah, this is something I heard from over and over again. I mean, again, I think that the benefits of playing youth sports or high school sports, they are cognitive, they are educational, and then they're also social. And so when you take away the opportunity to play youth sports, even for someone who doesn't necessarily want to go on to, play seriously at the varsity level or the college level, you're still taking away the cognitive benefit. You're still taking away the social linkage, and you're also taking away this opportunity for mentorship. So again, I think it can seem like a bit of a siloed story, like, oh, youth sports leagues are in decline, or, fewer kids are playing high school sports. How is that possibly a socioeconomic phenomenon? Well, it is for precisely these reasons. This is a scientific and social benefit to kids. And when you take it away, it hurts both the psychology and the social element of their upbringing.
Barb, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Derek, I wanted to get into another issue you brought up in your piece in The Atlantic about the expectation that kids would specialize in a sport. They had to devote more and more of their time and attention to that one sport.
Right. So there are two things to talk about here. First, it is clearly a phenomenon that parents are more interested in having their children specialize in a particular sport that they seem to show some aptitude for. There's a frenzy around early specialization. And this is probably true not only for sports, but also for a lot of other things. Now, specialization does two things. First, it probably increases the likelihood of injury and burnout. There was a 2015 paper from Harvard that concluded that essentially what they define as specialization, which is at least 1 year of intensive training in a single sport that means quitting other activities, that makes it more likely that these young people are either going to hurt themselves or that they'll actually ironically get bored of or sick of the sport and then pull out of it because of emotional exhaustion. Actually, there was one coach who likened the overwork of young athletes in basketball to an epidemic at the semi-professional level. But another thing that happens is that if you have specialization, it means that there are fewer kids in high school who are on multiple high school teams. Like if a teenager plays three sports, then they count as three distinct participants in each of those sports, you know, football and then basketball and then baseball. If you have them pull out of two of those sports and focus exclusively on football, it means that you have smaller high school teams for those other teams. And that can be bad for other players who didn't specialize. So I think from a variety of perspectives, early specialization, while it seems like a really attractive strategy to sort of maximize success for your student, can lead to injury, burnout, and also, you know, sort of hurt the ego and the joy that other kids have from that student's second and third most favorite sports.
Talking to Derek Thompson, staff writer for The Atlantic, about problems in youth sports. They're expensive, they require more time and specialization, it seems like, and it's keeping more low-income students from playing. He wrote about this in a piece in The Atlantic. Back to your calls now. Gene is with us in Richland Center. Gene, hi. Gene's gone. All right. Derek, talk about the competitiveness of youth sports now. It seems like, and I've heard this from other people over the years, it seems like there's not a place for the casual student athlete who wants to have fun, get some exercise, not that concerned with being on a super winning team.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly described my experience in high school. I played JV soccer, and I was not particularly competitive. I was not particularly talented, but I still got to hang out with my friends and run around, and it was a positive experience. I do think that, you know, one interesting way, one good way to think about this issue is flowing from the statistic that D1 and D2 colleges annually distribute $3 billion in student-athlete scholarships. 30 years ago, that number was 300 million. So the size of student-athlete scholarships has increased tenfold in 30 years. Now, what effect is that going to have? Well, if parents recognize that athletic success at the, you know, pre-teenage level, at the teenage level, at the high school level, is going to be really important for burnishing college applications, then richer parents are going to have the opportunity to spend a lot of money on enrichment programs to make sure that their children are the best set up to get some of that $3 billion pie for student-athlete scholarships. They're going to turn sports into just another pre-professional program with rising costs and hyper-specialization and what economists sometimes call opportunity hoarding among the privileged. That is essentially to say, I want my kid to be on an expensive travel team. I'm going to pay a lot of money to make sure that happens, even if the community rec league suffers as a result. And I think essentially that attaching sports to something that as prized as college outcomes has essentially forced American-style meritocracy to strangle the roots of youth sports and high school sports. And frankly, I think that it would be better for kids in a variety of ways if parents just chilled out about sports. And in order for that to happen, colleges would have to probably do the same.
And Derek, in our last 30 seconds, can we get there from here when it comes to the attention colleges are putting on this?
Yeah, this gets to maybe a whole other bag of worms, but I would like to see colleges spend a lot less on student-athlete scholarships. I would like them to spend a lot more on giving scholarships to students from low-income families or from students from families who, you know, don't have a parent who graduated from college. If today one of the biggest forms of affirmative action in American higher education is athletic recruiting, I think that's a problem, because higher education, I don't think, should be about athletic recruitment. I think it should be about education, and it should be about, you know, equality and undoing sort of the history of inequality that exists before these students enter college. So I would love, frankly, to see a lot of schools in this country divert the billions that they are spending on student athletes.
Thanks to Derek Thompson from The Atlantic. His recent piece is titled, "Meritocracy is Killing High School Sports."